Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Sarah Bowen, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. Since 1828, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speaker at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. Our speaker today, Leif Seligman, has been drawn to ministry since her childhood in Tennessee, where she dreamed of preaching with the power and glory of Martin Luther King, Jr. Introduced to Unitarian Universalism in seventh grade, Leif made it her spiritual home in her 30s. And after 13 years of teaching, mostly writing, at the University of New Hampshire, she attended Harvard Divinity School. Since her ordination in 2002, in addition to serving as chaplain in jails and a hospital, Leif served the congregation in London, Ontario, and is now the settled minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church, First Parish Church, in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, just 40 minutes south of here. She also currently teaches writing at Keene State College, as well as volunteering occasionally as facilitator for the Alternatives to Violence Project in area prisons. Leif lives among the trees in Troy, New Hampshire, with her black German shepherd, Zookie. And for the 20 years I've known her, she has listened intently as a writer, a teacher, and a minister to life's conversations and heard in the brokenness what makes us whole. Please join me in welcoming Leif.
Sometimes, writes the poet David Budbill, sometimes when day after day we have cloudless blue skies, warm temperatures, colorful trees, and brilliant sun, when it seems like all this will go on forever, when I harvest vegetables from the garden all day, then drink tea and doze in the afternoon sun, and in the evening one night make pickled beets and green tomato chutney, the next red tomato chutney, and the day after that pick the fruits of my arbor and make grape jam. When we walk in the woods every evening over fallen leaves through yellow light, when nights are cool and days are warm, when I am so happy, I'm afraid I might explode or disappear or somehow be taken from all of this. And at those times when I feel so happy, so good, so alive, so in love with the world, with my own sensuous, beautiful life, suddenly I think of all the suffering and pain in the world, the agony and the dying. I think about all those people being tortured right now in my name. But I still feel happy and good, alive and in love with the world and with my lucky, guilty, sensuous, beautiful life. Because I know in the next minute or tomorrow, all this may be taken from me. And therefore, I've got to say right now what I feel and know and see. I've got to say right now how beautiful and sweet this world can be. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here as part of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, where I have had the good fortune to hear many distinguished speakers. I thank the committee for inviting me, and all of you here, and the NHPR listeners tuning in, for the gift of your time and attention. As a Unitarian Universalist minister, I would be remiss not to note the irony of the Peterborough Church offering up its worship space during July and August for a stimulating series of secular talks. And while we Unitarian Universalists have a knack for taking summers off, be forewarned, you put a preacher in this gloriously raised pulpit in a beautiful sanctuary, and you are liable to see some tongues of fire licking these walls. I spent many a childhood hour on the grassy slope in front of my house in Tennessee, preaching to the ladybugs and the bumblebees, the skunk cabbage and the mock orange trees, and any other creatures I thought might listen as I poured my heart out. I grew up in an oral landscape of Pentecostal fervor, such that I, the daughter of fairly sedate Reformed Jews, dreamed of leading a tent revival. At the time, I knew nothing of the theological underpinnings of either the Pentecost or the modern tradition born in 1906 on Azusa Street, but I was entranced by such a visceral and vital expression of faith. Pentecost is the Greek name for the Jewish Feast of Weeks, deriving from its occurrence 50 days after Passover. According to the book of Acts, the apostles remained in Jerusalem after the resurrection appearances. And on the day of Pentecost, there they were gathered in one house when the Holy Spirit came upon them, sounding like a mighty wind and appearing like tongues of fire. I like to imagine Ruach, that holy wind, the breath of the universe blowing through me. We don't always apprehend the holy, so we create metaphors to ensnare it. All words are metaphors for what the body experiences. The 13th century poet Rumi wrote, "Stop the words now. Open the window in the center of your chest and let the spirit fly in and out." It sounds easy enough, opening the window, but keeping it open is for many of us a lifelong task. We have grown suspicious of spirit as if it were something higgledy-piggledy, ethereal, or superstitious. Even enthusiasm has its vocal skeptics. To be enthused is to be filled with spirit. Animate, alive, able to feel the pulse of creation in our breath, our heartbeat, our longing for justice, our yearning for connection. For many years, I taught in a university English department surrounded by brilliant colleagues, but I grew increasingly lonely there. Towards the end of my stay, I became far more interested in the spiritual well-being of my students, which is to say their nascent wholeness, than their mastery of college writing skills. I went from literary epigraphs at the top of my syllabi to an exhortation to make everything you write a love letter to the world. If you don't love the world, why be in it? And while I am nourished and in part sustained by the world of ideas, I have found when sitting with a parent whose child has just died that a philosophical treatise offers no comfort, whereas the capacity to be physically and emotionally present does. From the dualism of Descartes to the Age of Enlightenment, into an era of scientific empiricism that relies on the objectification of data and the objectivity of the observer, we have suppressed our senses and elevated, even deified, our robust intellect. In a recent essay in the New York Times, Diane Ackerman writes, "As a species, we've somehow survived large and small ice ages, genetic bottlenecks, plagues, world wars, and all manner of natural disasters. But I sometimes wonder if we'll survive our own ingenuity. We're living in sensory poverty, learning about the world without experiencing it up close, right here, right now, in all its messy, majestic, riotous detail. Watch how a vase of tulips, whose genes have traveled eons and silk roads, arch their spumoni-colored ruffles and nod gently by an open window. Notice the window to which Ackerman refers is open. If we open the window, could we feel what our Pentecostal brothers and sisters would recognize as the Holy Spirit? And why would we want to? We would want to, in the words of the playwright Paul Zindel, because we are part of a star that exploded too long ago to imagine. Because our first experience in utero is one of profound and literal connection. We begin the human journey embedded in a body and being of another who is not other at all. Her blood supply, her nutrients, her oxygen is ours. We coexist, and it is that original embodiment that shapes our being. We emerge only to have the umbilical cord severed to initiate disconnection. Yet because we already know in a way that precedes and surpasses cognition that all life is rooted in connection, we perpetually seek it, even as the political and economic realities we construct deny it. And while I'm sure we all appreciate and enjoy the privilege and plenty to which we are accustomed, it doesn't promote engagement with all being. It separates us. Because we're so used to what we have, it becomes unthinkable not to have it. Apparently, we will go to any length to keep and protect it. Most of the world's people do not have ready access to what they want. 1 out of 6 lacks clean water. The same number lacks adequate food. Most folks on the planet don't have ready access to electricity or the internet. Most can't afford to educate their children. Most can't hop in the car and go to the hospital or the doctor to get treated. We can, and so we do, and we are raised to believe that is how it should be, and we aspire to provide the same measure of access to our children, if not more. We all know how dependent we are on what we have, because now we rely on it. Yet the more embedded we are in a degree of plenty and a doctrine of prosperity globally unsustainable, the more we risk conflict over limited resources, and the quicker we view and quantify our fellow beings as resources. What happens to us spiritually when we perceive our kindred creatures as commodities instead of interwoven threads in the fabric of creation? What happens when we forget that how we live is neither representative nor sustainable? Now is the time to recall human existence prior to conceiving of ourselves exclusively as the knowers, before we relegated our co-inhabitants to the status of that which can be known. When we acknowledge our fellow creatures as capable of assembling and utilizing information about us and the rest of life, everything becomes every being. We relish our ologies, anthropology, climatology, psychology, zoology. But that doesn't mean we're unique in our capacity to observe, detect, experience the beingness of others. What distinguishes us is that our inquiry objectifies. We pursue knowledge in order to dominate, and in so doing, cleave ourselves from who and what and how we study. The Italian botanist Stefano Mancuso reminds us, plants are able to sense. Every single root apex is able to detect and monitor concurrently and continuously at least 15 different chemical and physical parameters. Plants communicate with other plants. They're able to distinguish kin and non-kin. They communicate with plants of other species, with animals, by producing chemical volatiles, for example, during pollination. Dogs read scent the way we scour the New York Times. Migratory birds navigate in ways that confound and astound us. Salmon return to their birthplace to spawn. Those of us who live with companion animals understand how well they know and play us like a finely tuned fiddle. I'm sure some of you have heard the vibrato on "I'll have just one more treat," or the tremolo on "Put the book down and pet me now." Instead of experiencing the interbeing that Thich Nhat Hanh speaks of, too often we consign ourselves to the loneliness of mastery and possession. Remember the fox and the little prince, who explains that to tame is to establish ties. The fox tells the little prince that though they don't yet feel connected, if the little prince tames the fox, they will need each other and come to recognize one another's essential nature and worth. When we become the vast catalogers of other beings, trading the terms of endearment for classification, we relish an intimacy both sustaining and spiritual. While it's impressive and perhaps useful to know the Latin names of species, consider what we often forget about the trees, how our very lives depend on them, that we inhale oxygen they expel while they filter the carbon we emit. Every moment of our lives is a French kiss. But instead of treating trees as our beloved, we view them as forests to manage and timber to cut. I don't mean to sentimentalize here. I heat with wood. And a score ago, when I was told to ask for help from a god of my understanding, I could conceive only of the trees who I so effortlessly believed in. Easily I prayed to the great beings who towered above, who dwelt for centuries, whose autumnal canopies arrested me with their beauty and instructed me in the grace of letting go. So what does it mean to burn the beings I so reverently behold? It deepens a relationship to pray to what we fell. It's why our ancient agrarian forebears blessed the animals they hunted, the trees they cut, the earth they tilled. It's why contemporary indigenous people still do. Blessing, as the healer and writer Rachel Naomi Remen puts it, occurs in relationship when we recognize and acknowledge each other's true nature and inherent worth. When we recognize a kindred spirit in a kindred being, we uplift ourselves. We engage into kun olam, mending the rent fabric of creation. It's not just our Pentecostal brothers and sisters who file into church on Wednesday and Sunday with the urgency of life at stake. Many of us who identify as secular or liberally religious may not truck with terms like sin or salvation. We don't often worry aloud about the fate of our souls, but we know, in the way we knew in utero, the inherency and urgency of connection. We know our lives are at stake. For many years, I taught incarcerated people. During a course called Explorations in Reading at the Women's Prison in New Hampshire, we managed to persuade the officer to let us hold a class session outside on the blacktop basketball court, where several women were sunning with their shirt sleeves and pant legs rolled up. And I looked beyond the wire fencing to a stand of trees and read aloud a Mary Oliver poem, "Some Questions You Might Ask," wherein the poet wonders about the nature of soul. Who and what have one? Is there a shape to it? And I told the women in class, "I love that poem because I believe trees have souls." And immediately someone suggested that when I die, my soul might enter a tree. "That would be perfect," I said, "as long as I don't end up a bench." We laughed, and another woman said, you could end up a piece of paper somebody writes on. And another piped up and said, you could end up being the disciplinary write-up form. No, not that, I exclaimed. But then it hit me. What if everything, every being potentially held some particle of spirit or soul of something or someone I loved? What if the disciplinary write-up form were printed on paper that came from a tree that possessed a great soul? The answer came tumbling out of my mouth. I would be more apt to treat all things and all beings more compassionately. My vision and relationship with the world and all its inhabitants would change. Rabbi David Cooper, in his book, God is a Verb, explains the five levels of soul. The first is nefesh, the Hebrew word for vital life force, which refers to the soul of atomic structure. Every particle of matter has nefesh. Rabbi Cooper cautions us against limiting soul to a particular body or entity. He likens it to a magnetic field, a kind of spiritual current that flows through everything, every being, connecting us all. Alice Walker begins her novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, with a line from a bumper sticker. When the axe entered the forest, the trees said, "The handle is one of us." To see ourselves in those who most definitively appear to be them is a kind of vision I desire, though it frightens me. Often when I feel tethered by fear, I long to be free of it. But there are moments when what I want is to be willing to be afraid and still enter the forest where the trees are brave enough to recognize themselves in the handle of axes that seek to cut them down. In part, that's why I began working in prisons, to find myself in those who reside there. That came easily enough, were it not for the privileges, the resources, the chances and choices I've been so abundantly given, but for the grace of God, there go I. The challenge was finding myself in the correctional officers. I thought a lot about who becomes one and why. And I remembered how I, too, once needed a job, which led to teaching in a locked adolescent unit in a psychiatric hospital, where we assessed and tallied behavior on point sheets, where fluorescent lighting and sealed chicken wire windows taunted fresh air and sun. No open windows there. I never really subscribed to the treatment model, nor did I like much of what I saw, but it paid well. To the teenagers on that unit, no matter how empathetic I tried to be, I was still staff, the hospital equivalent of correctional officer. When the axe entered the forest, the trees said, "The handle is one of us." Before I knew it, I found myself behaving like some of the correctional officers I'd observed. Leaning too far into the face of an angry adolescent whose confinement embittered him, I heard myself telling him, like countless other adults had, what I could do to him. And in that split second, he screamed at me, and I knew that I was powerless to change one iota of his pain. I reached for what power I could and did nothing but sully myself and fuel his cynicism. And I heard the words of Maya Angelou, who said there is nothing sadder than a young cynic, because she or he goes from knowing nothing to believing nothing. And in that moment of mutual frustration and powerlessness, neither of us believed that there was anything else to do. Neither of us recognized the soul of the other or anything or anyone we had ever loved. In that moment, the sparks of the divine lay dormant and dispossessed. We saw only the axe blade and not the handle. Each time I have volunteered in a penal facility, I have been warned. Do not trust the inmates. They're called cons for a reason. They will ask you for things and try to manipulate you. Not once in the 10 years I taught or brought in artists or speakers did anyone con or manipulate me. I did not expect them to. I offered my respect and they offered theirs in return. I have no doubt that prisons, like society at large, are rife with negative behaviors. They breed like bacteria on stale bread, seizing the most opportune conditions, distrust, disrespect, dehumanization. It's a challenge to enter a prison and keep cynicism at bay. It is a triumph of spirit to dwell there for an 8-hour shift or a sentence without surrendering one's humanity. In her morning poem, Mary Oliver speaks of daring to be happy. I asked the women in class what that meant to them. A woman said, "They hate it in here when we are happy. They can't stand to see us smile." There are many situations and circumstances that dare us to be happy. Think of a time someone might have said to you, "How dare you laugh at a time like this?" To quote one of my wisest teachers, our job is to stay in our joy. Later that afternoon in prison, when we had returned to the building, in the room we shared with the vending machines, we were all laughing, and I looked up to see four people with visitor badges on a tour of the prison staring in at us. "Now see," I joked, "they're going to think prison is fun." But underneath the irritation of being studied lay the recognition that the four people on the tour saw something important as they passed by. They saw incarcerated women who knew that their bodies could be chastened, but not their souls. Lives are a series of moments shaped by choices, tiny and large, that draw us in to fuller connection or propel us further from it. To open the window is to be aware. Consider how we eat, the most personal of choices for those of us with the luxury to choose. Entire industries exist to entice us with synthetic flavor and fat, to feed us in a jiffy while maximizing profit. Yet nothing so much as what we take into our bodies contributes to or diminishes buoyancy of spirit. The more we laden ourselves as so many of our brothers and sisters wither, the louder the cells of our body that long to be filled with spirit cry out. What we hear are sighs of fatigue and gastric distress, but the deeper rumbling is a shift in consciousness propelling us toward the window. And if we peer out of the window, we are likely to see chickens. Have you noticed how many people are raising chickens? Their backyard presence in cities and suburbs, as well as rural areas, evinces a yearning for connection. Yes, we want eggs from healthy, happy birds with room to move and no need for hormones or antibiotics. But there's more at stake than a tastier egg, the incredible edible that reminds us we were eggs once too. If you watch chickens in a backyard, they peck, scratch, socialize, nest. They engage with the world around them. They really do cross the road to get to the other side. True, they will not become Nobel laureates. But in their chickenness, they teach us that choosing to eat in a way that disregards the essential nature of another being undermines our own. A culture of defilement defiles the defiler. Whether we defile animals bred for food, people pushed to the margins, or the very earth that sustains us, we end up defiling ourselves. What's at stake for those of us who inhabit a world of ideas is a failure to notice that we've unplugged ourselves from the source of our being, which is connection. We open the window by noticing. As I recently heard it put, the most common blasphemy is not to see the human in the eyes before us. And I would extend the blasphemy to the failure to see the beingness in every eye, even that of a fly that annoys us with its buzzing. We enliven, we reconnect and recommit ourselves every time we notice. The great French philosopher Simone Weil said, "Absolute, unmixed attention is a form of prayer." No matter how crabby or vain, stimulating or dull, gaseous or fragrant we are in any given moment, we can choose attentiveness. Noticing is a spiritual act. This is not to suggest, however, that it is painless or easy. Noticing most often leads to feeling, and we all know incarnation can be messy. There's plenty of historical precedent for clamping down on sensation and emotion, corseting the heaving bosom and all it represents, our corporeality, our passion, our unmistakable creatureliness. We have only to recall the scowling response of King David's wife in the book of 2 Samuel. David danced before the Lord with all his might. His wife, Michal, looked out the window and despised him. It's no wonder Jews who settled in America, eager to assimilate, succeed, and stitch themselves into the fabric of the American dream, built a reform movement to distance themselves from the embodied prayer of ecstatic forebears who wrapped a phylactery around the arm and the forehead and davened, chanting prayers while swaying before God. Tidier to sit still for an hour than to shimmy like David, daring to enthuse. Initially, there is discomfort remembering the totality of ourselves. Remaining spiritually engaged demands that we inhabit painful paradoxes, that we discover meaning where there is none to be found, and in the midst of suffering, we answer the call to joy. Life is endless paradox. The uprisings known as the Arab Spring that morphed into a European summer and an American autumn gained global consciousness via cell phones and laptops assembled by workers every bit as constrained by the tyranny of exploitation as protesters constrained by the tyranny of despots. The tweets, photos, and instantaneous blogs documenting bloodshed and fear, resistance, martyrdom, combustion literal and figurative, did not ignite revolution, but they fueled the movements around the world that did. Where on the spectrum of justice do smartphones fall? How can it be that instruments used to bring forth justice are wrought without it? In 1972, Jigme Singye Wangchu, the fourth Dragon King of Bhutan, coined the term gross national happiness in his effort to build an economy based on Buddhist values. Spiritual engagement lies at the heart of shifting consciousness, another reason to open the window. Consider civil rights. our nation transformed by a spiritual movement grounded in faith and undeniable connection. As Cornel West points out, African Americans engaged in the struggle had no evidence that human decency would prevail after centuries of slavery and generations of Jim Crow. Yet it is those very individuals, bridled by brutality, who refused to succumb to hate or surrender to fear. Regrettably, the world is now so deeply saturated in fear that we rarely recognize it, much less name it. We respond out of fear instead of connection, waging war on terror as if war is not terror itself. We draw fiercer boundaries, enumerating what threatens us, while the iterations of human history keep inviting us to reach for that high-hanging fruit of justice. If longing for justice expresses the divine within us, our inability to attain it defines our humanity, grounding us in our feet of clay. Lynn Ungar, Unitarian Universalist minister and poet, writes in a poem entitled Hawks, "Surely you too have longed for this, to pour yourself out on the rising circles of the air, to ride unthinking on the flesh of emptiness. Can you claim in your civilized life that you have never leaned toward the headlong dive, the snap of bones, the chance to be so terrible, so free from evil beyond choice? The air that they are riding is the same breath as your own. How could you not remember the same swift stillness binds your cells in balance, rushes through the pulsing circles in your blood? Each breath proclaims it. The flash of feathers, the chance to rest on such a muscled quietness, to be in that fierce presence, holy wind, holy wild." In Zambia, where I traveled last winter for my cousin's wedding, some windows lack screens, obviously a danger in a malarial region. A truly open window summoned me to the reality of life beyond what I typically experience. In Africa, an open window is no longer a metaphor. On safari, in between 8 hours of game viewing a day, my aunt, uncle, and I lounge around the restaurant patio or retreat to our commodious tents replete with flush toilets and warm showers. After 2 days, we ride an hour into the interior of the game park and spend 3 nights at a bush hotel built as a presidential retreat. I am unprepared for the opulence that greets me upon arrival. I should know by the lovely gentleman who meets us holding a silver tray with scented face cloths, but somehow this does not prepare me for the grand lounge, the view from the veranda of elephants grazing in the distance. Our attendant, Dixon, shows me to my room. The entryway alone is 10 by 10. The ensuite bathroom boasts a full-length clawfoot tub, an enormous tiled shower, deliciously fragrant bath salts, all-natural herbal shampoo. I ask Dixon where he lives. In staff quarters, 2 to a room, 24 days on, 6 days off, he has a wife and young child at home. As he shows me how to operate the remote control for the air conditioner, I try to hustle him out, knowing I cannot hold back the lurching sob gathering in my throat. It's all too much, the neocolonialism so flagrantly expressed in the cadre of young black men assembled to wait on us, the artificial coolness of the room, the one-sided luxuriousness of guests seated around a table formerly laid for breakfast, lunch, dinner with 4 o'clock tea and drinks before dinner served to us on silver trays in the marble floored lounge. I feel like I'm on the set of Gone with the Wind. The first 2 days, I am full of questions, as if I am channeling my Russian emigre great-grandmother. On her one visit to Nashville during my childhood, when, good socialist that she was, she just wanted to see the living conditions of the poor blacks in the city. Why, I implore, do the staff who toil in the oppressive heat from 4 a.m. until 10 p.m. have no fans in their quarters? The answer is simple. They have no fans in their villages. Many have no electricity, so they're accustomed to the heat hotter than you're experiencing now. I press the matter, but surely the attendants notice the coolness of our rooms when they slip in to turn down our beds or pick up our laundry for complimentary washing. A female manager from the deluxe camping lodge owned by the hotel, a young black woman married to a white South African man, assures me she knows how I feel as the tears stream down my cheeks. But you must understand, she tells me, how grateful the men are to have such good jobs that afford them status in their villages. With their wages, they support many family members. And at this point, I remind myself of the people around the globe who leave home to find work. At least these men do labor in a clean, safe environment with a pleasant view. Next, I fixate on the glut of gourmet meals. I knot myself into a ball over the disparity of conditions, refusing to cool my room in solidarity with the workers. By day 3, I realize they would think me foolish, so I turn the AC on, low, of course, and only briefly. The male manager of the resort has his own air-conditioned quarters on site, but he works 60, even 90 days at a stretch before going home to his 2 young children in South Africa. He is in his 40s, a recent widower. Nothing is as simple as it seems. By day, our vehicles carve deeper ruts in the sanctioned routes, evidence of our environmental impact on a fragile ecosphere. The animals carry on, but I remain unconvinced that the leopard cub sleeping high on a branch with 5 spotlights aimed at its head on a night drive feels unencumbered any more than the nursing animal mothers protecting their young. Without tourism, scores of people in villages with extended families dependent upon them would be without jobs. And sadly, without the game drives and the park fees to give human value to the land, agribusiness from China and elsewhere would gobble up the hectares so fast the animals would cease to roam as if by fiat. The habitat compromised by our human presence is also sustained by it. And that paradox dazzles as much as a zigzag of zebras in their dizzying jumble of black and white. Our last day on safari, I am strumming my travel banjo on the porch when I am startled by a munching noise, and I look up to see 2 elephants eating leaves at close range. I am transfixed by their proximity. By the grace of a world that unites me with elephants under a sky no less colored by iniquity and paradox than the striations of sunset or that jeweled necklace of stars. And like David Budbill, I've got to say right now what I feel and I know and I see. I've got to say right now how beautiful and sweet this world can be. May your windows be open, and may joy alight. Alleluia and amen.
Thank you, Leaf. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking you, when did you really begin to notice that you were opening the window on a regular basis?
I think most of us have our windows open when we're born, and they start getting closed somewhere in childhood or adolescence or early adulthood. So I suppose I became conscious of keeping the window open or trying to open the window probably in my late 30s or 40-ish, when one day I was sitting in my room and the window was open, there was a screen, but I remember feeling a breeze come through and think, ah, I want to be as the screen is to the window and feel the wind come through me. So that's when.
Thank you. Okay, we have some questions here from the audience. You talk about seeing the us in them. We seem to be doing less and less of this in our country as we become more polarized. Do you have suggestions to help us towards seeing us in them?
That's a great and important question. And I don't know, other than just to really make it a discipline, to try to see the us in them. I mean, the only way I know to do it is to do it. So, for instance, I live in a road, a rural road, a dead-end road, and there's always a lot of, not always, but often some litter on the road that people who don't live there drop, and I get furious at them. And I just can't stand those ignorant people who leave their litter on the side of the road. And so I rant and rave, and then I try to find myself in them, and I say, well, who are they? And I say, well, they might be related to the part of you when you weed your garden and you take the weeds across the street to the empty property there. Or maybe they're related to you every time you throw away things that you can't recycle in Troy, New Hampshire, instead of simply not buying them. And then it gets us off our high horses. So the best way I know to do it, literally, is just to say, to stop yourself and say, where am I in that person? Or where can I find myself on the continuum of the action? So if you break it down and you say, well, I would never throw my trash on the side of the road, you might say, but we all know that everything we use stays on planet Earth. So even if we take it to the landfill, it's still sitting there. Oh, gosh, I guess I'm not a vastly different creature. So I guess that's how I do it. It's painful, but it's all I know to do.
Here's a question that says, would you speak to the question of how to help children connect to spirit?
That's a great question. I would say leave them alone. Let them do it. Cy Montgomery is here, and she's written books and hung out with children, and I know works in the natural world, so at the reception, ask Cy. I really do think that part of it is listening and watching children and obviously letting them be in that sense of wonder, and not shut it down. And to remember that they're, to let them enthuse. Because I think children really are, their ears are closer to the ground. They're a bit more like dogs. You know, they sniff, they put stuff in their mouth. We'd rather they not. They're more sensual. So I say let them do that, but still control them in public places so that they're not obnoxious.
Okay. Do you believe undomesticated animals communicate with us? What are they saying?
Yes, I believe that they're communicating with us. I wish I could tell you. I have a feeling that if they're saying stuff to us, it's not something I can repeat on public radio without getting bleeped. I don't know. Every day I have a prayer space, and I have 3 glass polar bears and a little photograph of a marmoset monkey in a research lab, and the little monkey is behind bars. And every day I have a prayer that somehow they will prevail. So I think that's what they're saying to us is, why do you not recognize us as kindred spirits? Why do you think we're yours to domesticate or to manage? That's what I hear them saying, but I am not necessarily a wildlife whisperer.
Okay, how about how do we defeat fear?
That sounds like someone else's Lyceum topic. But I suppose, I really think, though, that in part the answer is related to the us and them. Because if One of the things I try to do in my life is to really look at what is it that we all have in common. And I suspect that almost all of us have a desire to belong, to feel that sense of uterine connection that we knew before we knew things. And so I think if we can, partly the fear is if we can look at ourselves and say, well, what is it I'm afraid of losing? And then remember that probably the people who feel most other to us, whether they be people from other countries or whether they be the people we call terrorists or whether they be whatever it is, if we ask ourselves, well, if they at heart want what we want, how do we work with ourselves first? And I think things that we fear other than human behavior, I don't know, like what to do about poisonous snakes, I guess. Talk to snake whisperers. But.
This is a question on prisons. Please comment on the growing movement to privatize prisons, where the standing norm of punishment and degradation of prisoners will now be someone's profit-making business.
Well, I think it's not a good thing. I'm just not in favor of privatizing prison because, in part, I think it removes prison from the social responsibility we have. So if we as a society say our most creative response to this aberrant or violent behavior or our most creative response to legions of people who have mental illness and drug addiction and economic insecurity and systemic racism is to incarcerate them, to me, that shows a tremendous failure of imagination on our part. And so I think, though, to say not only do we have that lack of imagination, but we're going to pay other people to manage it, I think really removes us. It's part of the disconnection I'm talking about. So I think for that reason alone, it's important that we not do that. And I know lots of people would say, well, it's more troubling that the state of California spends more money on incarcerating individuals than higher education, which tells you where our values in this country are. But I think without those indicators of values, fewer of us will be motivated to get out there and rattle the chains for change.
Thank you. This is a big question.
Oh, like the others were small.
Yeah. A question to answer. Who is God?
Well, that is another Lyceum. That committee, are you taking notes? These topics are fabulous. I don't know who God is for anyone else. When I use the word God, for me, God, like all words, is a metaphor for all being. So for me, God is not a being. God is being, beingness itself. It is the thrum of creation of which we are all a part. So I don't know what other people have to say about that.
Okay, how do you envision us avoiding a global war to secure limited resources?
Share better.
Caught me unaware there. I have to get another question. How can people living in the middle of cities maintain a connection to nature?
Well, I suppose, I have to preface this by saying I'm an urban dweller, not an urban dweller, I'm a rural dweller, and I really don't cotton to cities much. But so I'm a bad one to answer the question. But I would guess, I certainly know there are lots and lots of people in cities who are doing really inventive things with green space, rooftops. There are people in cities who raise chickens. Obviously, there's some peregrine falcons who seem to roost on buildings in the city. But I think just to remember that the sky comes down to the ground, so you're surrounded by nature wherever you go. If you remember that the air you're breathing, even in the middle of Boston or Manhattan, came to you via the trees, you can remember that it's sort of like when you're a little kid. Like you can't see your ear, but it's really right there. So, in a city it may be harder to see nature, but just close your eyes and go, it's like my ear. It's right here.
Thanks. Okay, I think this is our final question. How may we become better in how we treat others?
As cliche as it sounds, I think it's a twofold answer, and the first part is by how we treat ourselves. You cannot give away what you do not have. So if you have no compassion for yourself, you sure can't extend it to someone else. So I would say the first thing we can do is to replenish our own wells, but concomitantly build wells that are right-sized. So be compassionate towards ourselves and remember that everybody else is our relation. Everybody else is connected to us. So I suppose when we're not very nice, it's sort of like if all day long you said ugly things to your big toe because it had fungus. Like, hey, ugly toe, I can't stand you. I mean, the toe after a while goes, I'm really going to start to hurt on you. And then it just makes the rest of your body terrible and your back's out of alignment and you get a tension headache in your neck, all because you were really rude to the toe who did not ask for the fungus. And so I think it's really similar that when we have an inclination to be rude to the people around us or not generous or just not think of the other beings, that we go a culture of defilement defiles the defiler. There's no exit. There's no way out. So if we fail to be compassionate, it's like the people who work in prison. You know, I figured out really early on that people who work in prison are in prison too. They just get to go home after 8 hours, but they labor there. And so we're in a closed system in that way. So I think what helps me to be compassionate is to think if I put negative or uncompassionate energy out there, that's what I'm breathing in the next breath. So that's my best answer to a very good question.
Well, that's great. Thank you again, Leif.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website, www.monadnocklyceum.org, or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next week will feature Christy Hager, who is the Regional Director for New England of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She will be speaking on a new era of health reform and, in particular, the New England experience. Thank you.